Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. You're listening to a free version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. If you want the total show without commercials, head over to ROFpodcast.com and become a member of this program. Look, this is our main source of revenue for Ring of Fire radio, and you can help keep us on the air by signing up for a Ring of Fire podcast membership. For far less than a cup of coffee a week, you can support this program and get our full show. Head over to ROFpodcast.com right now and sign up. Much appreciated.
Welcome to Ring of Fire Radio. I am Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar this week. Today on the show, the Democratic debate on Wednesday night was without a doubt one of the most intense of this entire primary season, and I'll give you my analysis on who the big winners and losers were from that evening. Ben Dixon's going to join me to discuss Michael Bloomberg's disgusting comments about his stop and frisk program. Investigative journalist Alex Koch is going to be here to tell us about Bloomberg's efforts to buy the Senate for the Republican Party. And Nomiki Konst will join me to talk about the media's hatred of Bernie Sanders. And don't forget, you can go to ROFpodcast.com, sign up for the free one-hour version of the Ring of Fire radio podcast. And if you want the full show commercial-free, you can become a member. That's the best way to help support the show. That's ROFpodcast.com. You can also support the show on Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/TheRingOfFire. So obviously one of the biggest things to happen this week, Wednesday evening, Democratic primary debate, six folks up on stage, first time, Michael Bloomberg gets to hang with the big dogs, right? This was his big debut. This was Michael Bloomberg's opportunity to show the rest of the country that he was more than just the multi-billionaire spending a few $100 million on this flashy ad campaign. Because after all, I mean, let's be honest, most of the people in this country only know Michael Bloomberg through the ads that he is running. You know, I'm down here in Florida, obviously. He's running ads down here, and this is the only way we know who this guy is. The average American who's not been paying attention to politics as closely as some of us do, they have no idea. And they were given that opportunity to see who this man was, see what he was all about, see how he could hang with the rest of them. And Bloomberg could not have failed any harder than he actually did. And we have to give credit where it is due. Part of the reason that Michael Bloomberg failed so spectacularly is because of Elizabeth Warren. Elizabeth Warren had her strongest debate performance ever on Wednesday night. It was absolutely remarkable. And before I get into the specifics, I do have to say, I mean, when you look at the Elizabeth Warren who showed up at this debate on Wednesday night, had this same version of Elizabeth Warren shown up at all of these other debates that we've had over the last, 8 months, I think we'd be looking at a very different field right now. I do not think she would have been coming in, below the top three in both Iowa and New Hampshire. I'm not saying she'd be the front runner, because obviously there are some issues with her policies and where does she actually stand? Is she going to pick a stance and stick with it? It's the fighter, the toughness, the Elizabeth Warren that we remembered prior to all of this primary, that's who came out on Wednesday. And I got to say, it was great to see her again. We missed her. So anyway, Elizabeth Warren comes out there, knives out, ready to attack, and Bloomberg was the first person she went after. I mean, her opening line here, I'd like to talk against a billionaire who calls women fat broads and horse-faced lesbians. And no, I'm not talking about Donald Trump. I'm talking about Mayor Bloomberg. She immediately pounced on him and specifically, obviously focused on the misogyny that we have seen come out from Bloomberg in these, you know, past interviews, all of the allegations against him now. She jumped on it and immediately drew blood right there in the first couple minutes of that debate. And that really set the tone, because once she came out and decided, I got to get this guy, I got to go after him, everybody else also obviously piled on. Bloomberg was forced to answer questions about the non-disclosure agreements, the NDAs that he had people sign. A lot of women had to sign these, not allowed to talk about what happened at work or the campaign. And he was asked point blank, will you let these women out? In fact, Elizabeth Warren is one who asked, are you going to let them out of the NDAs? Bloomberg would not commit to that. He claimed that these were consensual. He used the word consensual NDAs. These were consensual. And I guess it's up to the women. And then Joe Biden piles in and says, hey, it's pretty easy. Mayor, all you got to do is say, I release you from the NDA. Are you willing to do that? And he wasn't. So God only knows what's going to come out from that. But if any of the former employees out there sign these NDAs, Bloomberg says it's up to you. So we have that. Obviously, the country just saw him say that. So, OK, it's up to you. You want to get out of it. Bloomberg just gave you your out. Take it. Take advantage of that. He said it on national TV. It is up to you. So in terms of violating an NDA, when the guy that made you sign it goes on TV and says you can basically get out of it if you want to, that's a pretty strong legal argument. I can't say that it completely absolves you of any legal problems, but, you know, I think that's a very good out for these people if they want to start talking, and I think they need to start talking. We had some other moments of fireworks, I guess you would call it. Another big argument, aside from the one that Elizabeth Warren was having at Michael Bloomberg, because he really didn't, he wasn't necessarily a part of it. He was the target, and he was just getting whipped the whole time. So he wasn't really part of that debate. He was just sitting there having to take it. But Elizabeth Warren also went after Amy Klobuchar and attacked her for her, you know, policies that are just a couple of paragraphs. You know, really hammering on the fact that Klobuchar has no idea what to do for the country. And that's the thing. You know, we look at some of these other candidates, we know where they stand on issues. You know, we know where Bernie stands. We kind of pretty much know where Elizabeth Warren stands. We know where Biden stands. We know where Pete stands on a couple things. But what about Klobuchar? And that Elizabeth Warren did a phenomenal job of pointing that out. Like, why are you here? What are you going to do for this country? Why are you even bothering to show up for this thing? Right? You got a couple of paragraphs about some of the biggest issues in the country and that's it? No, that's garbage. You need to do better. Buttigieg also jumped in kind of on the dog pile on Amy Klobuchar throughout the debate. The two of them had a pretty intense back and forth. And I think overall, Buttigieg is the one who came out looking better. He called Klobuchar out on her votes for Donald Trump's judicial nominees. And her best response to that was, well, I voted against about 2/3 of them. Again, horrible. You know, the issue isn't, well, you voted. No, you can't vote for any of them. Like, they're all horrible. We here at Ring of Fire, through our YouTube channel, through our other outlets, we have been talking about how horrible all of Donald Trump's judicial nominees are. So it doesn't matter if you voted for 100% of them or 33% of them. You should have voted for 0% of them. And Klobuchar tries to wear it as a badge of honor that, well, I voted down 2/3 of them. So how about that, folks? No. A vote for one of them is too many. and you're sitting there trying to convince us that just because you didn't vote for 100% of Donald Trump's judicial nominees, that somehow you should get a trophy for this. No, Buttigieg was right to call her out on that. Got to take a quick break. There's a lot more news to cover about the debate. When we come back, I am Farron Cousins in for Sam Cedar, and you're listening to Ring of Fire Radio.
I got caught when I was young, kicking shins, throwing glass like brittle scarves. That boy's gone now, I'm a shadow, frightened of the creature.
Hey folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar today. Right now, I'm running through the biggest news stories of the past week, which at the moment is really just the Democratic debate and what happened on that Las Vegas stage. So before the break, we were talking about the debate. I mentioned Elizabeth Warren coming out there, giving her best performance ever, going after Bloomberg, going after Klobuchar. She took a couple of shots at Pete and Biden, took some shots at Bernie. But overall, I do think it's fair to say that simply based on performance, not necessarily candidate preference, I think it's fair to say that Elizabeth Warren won that debate. I think Bernie was second. Biden, I would have to give him third place just because he didn't do anything crazy. You know, he didn't trip up and slip up, and he got some good zingers in there against the other candidates, and I'm going to talk more about his performance in just a second because he did a lot of things I don't like. I would say Buttigieg was fourth, Klobuchar a very low five, and then Bloomberg, of course, the big loser. And it's funny, too, because all the headlines today, everywhere out there, you know, in the days after this debate, talking about the fact that Bloomberg got his behind handed to him, and he did. Nevertheless, immediately following this debate, you had Kevin Sheekey, who's the campaign manager for Michael Bloomberg. He came out and he issued this statement. He said, "You know you are a winner when you are drawing attacks from all the candidates. Everyone came to destroy Mike tonight. It didn't happen. Everyone wanted him to lose his cool. He didn't do it. He was the grown-up in the room." Now, he was the guy, Kevin Sheekey, that got exposed as the misogynistic racist that he is. That's what we learned. I mean, the guy tried to write off the harassment allegations against him by dozens of women, by the way, just like Donald Trump, tried to write it off as, you know, I'm from a different time, just how I was brought up. And then he said some of it is just women who just didn't quite get my jokes. For Stop and Frisk, he said, "Oh, you know, that's pie. Apologize. It's such a bad thing that I inherited. But you know what? It worked." Immediately after apologizing for it, which is one of the biggest reasons Bloomberg's even in hot water at the moment, he apologizes for it, and then he comes out and says, "But it worked. I look at the crime rate when I came in. Look at the crime rate when I left. Stop and Frisk worked." The policy that this man is so hated over All he had to do was apologize, but instead he defended it with a phony apology and an explanation as to why he did it. We didn't want an explanation. We wanted you to come out and genuinely be disturbed by your own behavior and your own statements about that policy. That is what we wanted, and you failed to do it. And here's the thing. You had 7 days, seven straight days. You're not even on the ballot in the next two states, which is Nevada and South Carolina, next Saturday. So you had more than enough time. You didn't even have to focus on the next two caucuses and primaries. All you had to do for seven straight days before that debate, after that tape came out, courtesy of Ben Dixon, who's coming up later in the show, all you had to do, Michael, was come up with a genuine response. And you didn't do it. You thought that your smug arrogance that comes from being the eighth or ninth or whatever you are, richest human being in the United States, you thought that was going to get you through it. You bought your way onto that debate stage. The DNC changed their rules to let you get onto that debate stage, and you fell flat. You should have been more careful what you wished for, because it didn't go the way that you wanted to. It probably didn't go the way that the DNC wanted to. But that is what it is. Now, as I mentioned, I want to get back to Biden for a little bit, because Biden not been doing well, obviously, in the first caucus and primary, underperformed. And then at the debate, as I had said, you know, obviously he didn't do anything crazy or stupid. He was coherent and he had a little bit more energy than he usually does. But there were only a few times that he spoke where he did not mention the name Barack Obama. And the more I thought about it as I'm watching this debate, I actually got kind of sad and I started to feel really bad for him, because that is all this man has. If Joe Biden hadn't been the vice president of the United States, he wouldn't even have been on that stage last night. And I know people say, well, yeah, obviously. But here's the thing. No, think about it. The only reason he's even still in the primary to begin with is because he is still riding Obama's coattails. And he wants everybody to remember that he worked with Barack Obama, that he was the vice president with Barack Obama, that he knows all these other world leaders because of Barack Obama, that when it came to the Affordable Care Act, he sent Joe Biden out there to go, quote, get the votes. Which is actually kind of a sad statement, too, that he even had to go out there and campaign to get the votes, considering the Democrats controlled the House and the Senate. I mean, you would think those votes would have been in the bag, which I'm pretty sure they were. And that's why Joe Biden's boasting about that kind of rang hollow. Like, you guys had the House and the Senate and the White House. This was a shoe-in. You didn't have to do much work with that, Joe, and yet you're out here trying to make it sound like Obama trusted me to do it. He sent you on a fool's errand. He knew you couldn't screw it up because it was already in the bag, buddy. And then, of course, Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders got some great shots in at Michael Bloomberg, mostly talking about his wealth. He was asked, you know, billionaires shouldn't exist. Defend that statement. He defended it perfectly. Told Michael Bloomberg, you didn't create the wealth that you're enjoying. Your employees did that. And that is a brilliant point that more and more people really need to understand. Look around at these billionaires, millionaires in this country. Very few, if any of them, actually just created this on their own. It takes a team. And as you get bigger, it starts to take a village. And it's fine if you make a lot of money doing it, as long as you take care of every single person that has put you there and let them live happy, comfortable lifestyles. And unfortunately, we see too often in this country, in this capitalistic system, that isn't what happens. And that's what Bernie was calling out. Coming up, I'll be talking with investigative journalist Alex Koch about Bloomberg's history of buying Republican seats in Congress. That's just ahead, so stay with us right here on Ring of Fire Radio.
Oh, hot sand on toes, cold sand in sleeping bags. I come to know that memories were the best things you ever had. The summer shorn, beat down on bony back. So far from home where the ocean stood, down dust and pine.
Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like the Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a five-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found. Hey, folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You got to check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America. Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
Welcome back to Ring of Fire Radio. I'm Farron Cousins, sitting in for Sam Cedar today. Michael Bloomberg is clearly using his money to buy his way into the Democratic primary, but he's actually spent the past few years using that same money to buy seats for other politicians. Most of them happen to be Republicans. This money has effectively solidified a Republican majority in the Senate, and I'm joined now by investigative journalist Alex Koch to tell us how this happened. So, Alex, we have seen Michael Bloomberg come in. He has bought his way into this Democratic campaign, bought his way onto the debate stage several times, but that's not the only thing over the years that he has been buying. Michael Bloomberg has absolutely, as you point out in a great new piece on exposedbycmd.org, he has bought Republicans in D.C. a lot of power over the last decade. So take it from there. What else has Michael Bloomberg been funding other than his rise to the White House?
Yeah, well, I think that since during his time as mayor in New York, this is over a decade ago, he started to, you know, really pump a lot of money into both parties, and not only to campaigns, federal campaigns, but state parties as well, especially the New York Republican Party, of course, where he is from. But, you know, I looked at the Federal Election Commission records, which are just the federal election, not the state elections. And he's donated almost $1 million directly to Republican candidates, campaigns, and Republican Party committees. So that's just direct campaign and party donations. He spent a lot more funding his own super PAC called Independence USA, which has supported Democrats and Republicans. And he also funds a lot of other super PACs. More lately, they're more Democratic kind of party line PACs. But in the last 6 or 7 years, he's also funded super PACs that spent money to help senators like Susan Collins, Lindsey Graham, Thad Cochran. These are Republicans who are still in the Senate. And you know, especially someone like Collins and someone like Graham, these are two people who have directly enabled Donald Trump, especially in terms of a lot of his sort of impeachable offenses. So it's kind of strange credulity to think that the guy who was bankrolling Pat Toomey in Pennsylvania to the tune of $6 million from his own personally financed super PAC is really going to be able to handle the Republicans and work to pass Democratic legislation if he's president.
Well, and what's interesting about this is obviously Bloomberg was a registered Democrat up until about 2000. Then he switched to Republican to run for governor or mayor of New York, excuse me. But he switches to Republican 2018, switches back to Democrat because it's politically expedient for him to do so. It was politically expedient back in 2000, or at least he believed it was. And so far, it's paid off for the guy. But during that time when he considered himself a Republican, was running as a Republican, and it won him the mayorship, but he was funding all of these other Republicans, defeating Democrats left and right. He would go after, as you point out in this article, he would go after Democrats that didn't necessarily side with the issues that he liked. So this is who this guy is. And I think this paints an amazing picture that shows us that he is a lot, obviously, like Donald Trump. You need to support what I support. You need to do what I want you to do. Otherwise, I'm going to spend as much money as it takes to help defeat you and put somebody else in your place that's going to do what I want them to do. That's a lot of what this is telling me here.
Yeah, well, I'm glad you brought up his first party change, because he was a Democrat until 2000. And he wanted to run for mayor of New York City in 2002. Well, the mayor at the time in 2000 was Rudy Giuliani, and this is long before he became one of Trump's biggest idols. He was a very popular mayor at that point. And so Bloomberg switched to Republican because, you know, if Giuliani was terming out, then he thought maybe the next mayor was probably going to also be Republican, given Giuliani was popular. And then in about 2007, during his during the end of his second term as mayor, he switches to independent. He kind of sees the tide turning. You know, the next year, Barack Obama was elected president. So he kind of saw that happening. George W. Bush was waning in favorability after being pretty popular in the early years of his presidency. So he just kind of follows where the wind blows. Meanwhile, his partner, a long-term partner, they're not married, but it's his romantic partner, switched from Republican to Democrat in 2018, in October, when Bloomberg decided to switch from independent to Democrat. So he switched, clearly, obviously switched to Democrat just so he could run in the Democratic primary. Of course, he's not like Bernie Sanders, who is running as a Democrat from the left of the party. Bloomberg is running from as an independent or a former independent from the right of the party. And that's why you see a lot of this fundraising he's given to Republican senators. And also what you said is correct. You know, not only was he helping elect Republicans, he was also trying to decrease the campaign funding of Democrats who didn't necessarily sign on to his gun control initiative. And a lot of these are Democrats who lost their seats to Republicans. Again, this is why I argue that he really helped Republicans take and then maintain control of the Senate. So he was encouraging big Democratic donors, hundreds of them, in 2013 to stop donating to senators like Mark Begich, Mark Pryor, Heidi Heitkamp. They all ended up losing their seats to Republicans, two of them in 2014 and Heitkamp in 2018. Now, these are centrist Democrats. They're not exactly going to be endorsing the Green New Deal or anything, but they're certainly legislatively, in terms of their votes, a lot more liberal than, say, Pat Toomey or even Susan Collins in many cases.
And 2012, Bloomberg endorsed Scott Brown in Massachusetts over Elizabeth Warren. But yeah. I think one of the things that people don't quite understand is that, yes, Bloomberg has been quite the party hopper. He does whatever he needs to do to get elected or to get ahead. So he'll switch parties here and there whenever he feels the need to. But as we've seen recently, his ideology has not changed. Bloomberg is who Bloomberg always has been. And that is a Republican at heart. It may not always say Republican on his voter registration piece of paper, but this guy's policies, the things he has been pushing, and the most of the people he has been funding, it's all right wingers. I mean, that's who this guy is. So just because he puts a D next to his name, or he puts an I next to his name, and sometimes an R, it doesn't change the fact that on his soul, it says Republican. And by God, he's going to do what Republicans do. And I think that's all finally coming out about him in a slow trickle. But hopefully this is really going to become a problem for him.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a question if the word gets out properly. I mean, obviously, we've been seeing all the really heinous things he said about men of color in terms of crime and how the police should treat them. Just 5 years ago in 2015, I saw a video last night. He said he was always opposed to raising the minimum wage. It was $7.25 then, and it's $7.25 now. You know, the Democratic Party is largely supporting $15 minimum wage, and that was Bernie Sanders in 2016 when Hillary Clinton refused to go to 15, and she thought 12 was a good federal minimum wage. And, you know, Bernie pushed the party to $15, and now it's kind of pretty unanimous among the candidates. Even Bloomberg now is saying he will do that, which obviously can't really be true, given that his lifelong commitment to not raising and even opposing the wage in some cases entirely. To be fair, he has funded a lot of Democrats, a lot of Democratic super PACs. He helped some Democrats win in 2018 in the House, which has actually ended up being quite a good investment for him because several of them are endorsing him for president now. I think he has up to 14 by now endorsements from Democratic members of the House. You know, Mickey Sherrill, a sort of centrist Democrat from New Jersey, endorsed Bloomberg. Bloomberg Super PAC Independence USA spent over $2.2 million on ads supporting her in 2018. So she repays him with an endorsement. You have Harley Ruta in California. Independence USA spent $4.5 million against the incumbent Dana Rohrabacher, who Ruta was able to beat, and then he endorsed Bloomberg now. Haley Stevens, $2.2 million. She endorsed Bloomberg. So there's more, you know. And so it's not just that he has bankrolled Republicans, but it's clearly kind of a pay-to-play thing with him helping out the Democrats. And just to go one step further, it's not even just funding Democratic campaigns. It's funding Democratic or liberal groups like Stacey Abrams, the gubernatorial candidate from Georgia who narrowly lost. And I think it was the race was stolen from her by Brian Kemp, the right. Secretary of State at the time in Georgia. You know, she ran a good campaign, but she did not win, and she started a voting rights group right after because of all the shenanigans that went down there. Apparently, last November, she said she had a fundraising goal of $5 million for a certain time period. The next month, December, Bloomberg drops $5 million into the group, and then the following month after that, the January, just last month, he was invited to give a speech at her group's event in Georgia. So she wasn't endorsing Bloomberg, but she was saying, hey, look, I mean, you gave me this money. That's great. I'm going to put you on stage next to me and, you know, you're going to look good. And then just last night, the other day, she said that she had no problem with anyone spending unlimited amounts of money to help our democracy. If that the irony isn't lost there.
Right. Listen, we have to take a quick break, but I want to pick up with that because there's some things to talk about with Bloomberg and Stacey Abrams in a little bit more in depth. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll pick right up with more from that.
Hey folks, Sam Cedar here. If you like Ring of Fire Radio, and if you like The Majority Report, have I got news for you. Every morning, we do a 5-minute podcast. It's less than 5 minutes, in fact, and it gives you all the top headlines you're going to need to know throughout the day. It's called the AM Quickie. We deliver all this news, and we do it really quick, and we do it in the morning. That's how we came up with the title, AM Quickie. You can sign up at amquickie.com or wherever your podcasts are found.
I'm a trial lawyer. I've spent countless hours poring through documents that tell the story about the ugliest side of corporate America.
Fraud.
Corporate media refuses to talk about these issues.
The conduct by this company was deplorable.
I'm going to paint a clear picture about how disturbing, how corrupt corporate conduct has become in modern America. These are stories that no one else can tell. I'm Mike Papantonio, host of America's Lawyer. Question more.
Find out more at ringoffireradio.com.
We're back on Ring of Fire. I'm Farron Cousins from Ring of Fire's YouTube channel. I've been sitting in for Sam Cedar today, and right now I am talking with Alex Koch, an investigative journalist with the Center for Media and Democracy, about how Michael Bloomberg has used his money to help Republicans retain the Senate. So, Alex, right before the break, you were telling us how Stacey Abrams, the former gubernatorial candidate from Georgia, who basically did have her election stolen from her, she by all measures should have won that if Republicans hadn't engaged in the shenanigans they did that helped steal the election. But nonetheless, she starts this, election integrity project. Bloomberg comes in, gives millions of dollars to that. He comes up on stage with her at a recent event. She doesn't endorse him, but she's also now kind of saying, hey, it's okay if people come into the election and spend all this money. Isn't that great? And she says, Yes, I would absolutely be okay with being a vice presidential pick. Not necessarily those things said at the same time, but we're hearing hints now, you know, from Abrams herself as well, that, hey, maybe a vice presidential run is not out of the question. And Bloomberg, given all of his comments that have come out recently about African-Americans and women, boy, it sure looks like he could kind of bolster his campaign if he picks somebody like Stacey Abrams, doesn't it?
Oh, 100%. I mean, first of all, let me just preface this by saying, look, I think her group, A Fair Fight, is undoubtedly going to be doing good stuff with voting rights and getting more people to the polls. That's great.
Yeah.
I also sort of question, like, she was sort of seen since her loss, her near victory in Georgia. She's really kind of been seen by a lot of the pundit class as kind of the next big rising star in the party. I'm not super convinced necessarily that it's going to be her. I just think that there's sort of a vacuum in the party for kind of, you know, progressive but not too left, you know, black women of color kind of who are succeeding. You know, someone like Kamala Harris kind of didn't do so well in the Democratic primary, had to drop out because she couldn't raise enough money to stay in. You know, so I think like sort of the pundit class in the Democratic Party establishment, kind of on the liberal side of that, are really hungry for someone, perhaps Abrams, perhaps someone else, to kind of be a woman of color and lead the party. But I don't know. Like, if you look at her past, I mean, she's not really that progressive, and you can see the party really moving to the left now that Bernie Sanders is the clear front runner among Democrats. And just the latest national poll, he's up by I think 12 points in a general election poll of Democrats and Democratic leaning independents. So I'm just going to preface this by saying I'm not so sure she's going to be the next big thing, but maybe. But that's kind of beside the point. Like you say, I mean, it's not just Abrams kind of recently going on the record, and it was the same interview, by the way, where she said that she has no problem with Bloomberg spending all the money, and she would obviously be happy to be anyone's vice president. But it was the day after that Benjamin Dixon video came out about Bloomberg's really awful comments about Stop and Frisk and men of color. Three House Democrats who are all black endorsed it. Gregory Meeks from New York, Lucy McBath from Georgia, and Virgin Islands House Delegate Stacey Plaskett all endorsed him the following day. Now, I also think we need to make the distinction between someone who literally may have just benefited from campaign help and someone who is perhaps really impacted by an issue that Bloomberg cares about. So Lucy McBath lost her black teenage son to a white police officer. You know, he was murdered, one of the high-profile, awful, awful murders. And then Bloomberg really helped, I believe, in Georgia with a lot of gun control. She became kind of what I perceive to be a pretty one-issue politician about gun control. So obviously you understand that. It didn't hurt that Independence USA also spent $130,000 backing her in 2018 so she could win a really tough election. So I'm not saying she wouldn't have endorsed him if he hadn't spent the money, but what he does is he curries favor with people, and then he also might spend money on their elections directly, and then it kind of leads to good favor. And so the day after, you know, he's dealing with probably definitely the biggest image crisis of his campaign so far, he has people who make him look good come out and support him.
Well, okay, so here's the thing. Bloomberg is essentially doing with his money what we have seen from the pharmaceutical industry, from the healthcare industry in general, and from Wall Street, right? They, even though they tend to give a little bit more to Republicans, they do, for the most part, kind of spread it out a little bit evenly. And that's a good way to hedge your bets. It's like walking up to a roulette table and putting money on both black and red. You're, you know, 66% chance there that you're going to get, you know, money, that it's going to benefit you in some way. And I see Bloomberg doing that, you know, through what you've written about here with all of his donations. And sure, some of his money has gone to good things, right? His efforts to tackle guns in the United States is absolutely a great thing. But you negate it when you turn around, as Bloomberg has done, and then fund these politicians that you know will never support your efforts. They will never support expanded background checks. They will never support anything that's going to reduce gun violence in the United States. So you're working against yourself at that point. And we see Bloomberg doing that just from a quick look at the numbers here, right?
Well, you know, to be clear, I mean, his support for Pat Toomey, for example, was because Toomey had said he supported a limited background check bill that he was going to write. I don't believe anything's happened with that since. But what he is working against are Democratic priorities in general. I mean, Pat Toomey is kind of your middle of the road Republican senator. He is not going to vote for most Democratic initiatives. I don't think he's going to be very excited about phasing out oil and gas. Obviously, Bloomberg himself is not. He supports fracking. He just wants to phase out coal and perhaps some dirty oil. But, you know, that's what he's doing is, you know, he's trying to run as the Democratic Party leader to really represent the party when all these people that he's helped put into Congress, keep in Congress, are actively working against most of the main Democratic priorities. And if he's president, maybe he could pass a very, very limited background check bill. The thing is, every other Democrat running also wants those and probably more. So it's not like Bloomberg just comes with the money, right? I mean, even if you're a single issue person, gun control is your only issue. The difference between Bloomberg and the other candidates is literally just he has gazillions more dollars. But, you know, as president, I think if he's putting a lot of his own money into activism as president, I'm not sure that's not going to look really great to ethics enforcers. So I honestly think the money's going to probably decrease if he becomes president. And lastly, you know, his advisor, Howard Wolfson, told, I believe, the New York Times in that article that came out recently about his giving, that if he doesn't win the Democratic nomination, his spending, quote unquote, will be a bit different in the general election. In other words, and he went on to elucidate, said, well, if he wins the nomination, we're going to put money in every state. Democrats down the ballot in every state are going to do well. If he doesn't win, well, it's going to have to be targeted. It's going to be a little reduced. So, I mean, that's almost a threat.
Yeah.
You're threatening the party you're trying to run with. It just doesn't make any sense.
Well, that's, you know, we've seen it time and time again, and I hate to go back to this well, but we see it all the time with Trump. This is what rich people do, and this is affluenza at the highest levels. You don't play ball with me, you don't get any of my money. Alex Koch, Center for Media and Democracy, thank you very much for talking with us today.
Oh, yeah, thanks so much for having me.
We have to take a quick break, but there is more news to come at the top of the next hour. That's just ahead, so stay with us right here on Ring of Fire Radio.
Hey folks, it's finally out. Mike Papantonio's Law and Addiction. Papantonio pulls back the curtain on America's deadly opioid epidemic in this spellbinding thriller about greed, corruption, and the power of personal conviction. You gotta check this out, folks. There's so much behind this opioid epidemic that will never make the papers, will never come out after court battles, after failure of the U.S. government in many respects to hold these people to account. Sometimes fiction ends up being the best way to tell what amounts to an amalgamation of true stories. So check it out. The book, Law and Addiction, by one of the foremost tort attorneys, plaintiff attorneys in the country. He's a bulldog, Mike Papantonio, and he has been in the trenches, and he is letting you in on the inside story. Check it out at MikePapantonio.com.